This episode includes descriptions of physical and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised. In unincorporated Santa Fe County, roughly 15 miles south of New Mexico's capital city, sits a large facility. Today, it is mostly abandoned, but it was once a state-of-the-art facility constructed to house New Mexico's worst and most violent inmates. You may know this set from famous films or TV productions. Most notably, the film was used as the primary filming location for the mid-2000s Adam Sandler football comedy, The Longest Yard, where it was rented for $1,000 a day by the production company. That is a pretty regular cost, as the facility has also been used to film All the Pretty Horses, a Cormac McCarthy adaptation, and The Hunt for Bin Laden, where, funnily enough, the set acted as a stand-in for Pakistan. In most of these productions, the filming crews have made note of odd, unexplained phenomenon during their stay there. Things like doors closing mysteriously, loud disturbing noises in the hallways, stuff like that. This has even led some to claim that this facility is haunted. Surprisingly enough, they have a reason to believe so. You see, this building, which was closed in November of 1998, was the site of a violent uprising, which resulted in hundreds being hospitalized, and left dozens dead in its wake. In particular spots in this building, hatchet marks can be found on the ground. Marks that crews were unable to work out of the flooring. These are the spots where one inmate had his head severed from his body, and another where a one-armed man nearly lost his remaining arm to a berserk biker. These are just two such examples of the violence that continue to haunt these hallways. Reminders of a prison riot that was nearly as deadly as the infamous Attica uprising, but noticeably more cruel and heartless. It is a story so inhuman and monstrous that I have struggled with this story for months as I debate how to present it, if at all. This is the story of the New Mexico State Penitentiary Riot. Welcome to Unresolved. This episode is the first part of three, and if you haven't already guessed, based on the introduction, is going to include descriptions of extreme violence, some of which is sexual in nature. If you are one that is not prepared to hear such descriptions, I do apologize, but I would highly encourage you sit this story out. If you would like to support the podcast, please consider leaving the podcast a rating and review on iTunes or Apple Podcast. And if you would like to go one step further than that, you could head to patreon.com/unresolvedpod to become a patron for as little as $1 a month. Any help you can offer would be much appreciated. And if you want to learn more about the podcast, please listen through to the close or head to the podcast website, unresolved.me. Now, without any further ado, let's learn a bit more about how the situation at the New Mexico State Penitentiary deteriorated in the first chapter of the story, Powder Keg. W.G. Stone is an alias used by a prisoner who arrived at the New Mexico State Penitentiary in 1962. At the time, Stone was just 22 years old and terrified. He had recently been convicted of armed robbery and given a prison bid lasting anywhere between 10 and 50 years. Upon arriving at the state pen, Stone was sent to the hole, a section of the prison located underneath cell block 3. There, life consisted of a simple 6-foot by 9-foot cell, which had close to nothing in it. Each prisoner was stripped naked before entering the hole, and they were each given a thin blanket, a metal cup, and a toothbrush. Between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., each prisoner was given a thin, slightly disgusting mattress, which had likely not been cleaned in several months, if not years. Inside the hole, each prisoner was given a hot meal every 3 days. In between those 3 days, each prisoner was given 6 slices of bread to subsist on. No protein, vegetables, or anything like that. Just bread. Each prisoner received a minute or two of water access each day, which came via a water faucet being turned on what seemed like randomly, in that limited period of time, which again was just around a minute or two in length. Prisoners had to fill up their metal cup, drink whatever they could, attempt to wash and or bathe themselves, brush their teeth, etc. Oh, and did I mention, the toilet, if you can call it that, was just a little hole in the ground, which, just like the water access, would only flush randomly. Sometimes it would not flush for days, and no prisoner in the hole had access to toilet paper, so, yeah, you can use your imagination to fill in the rest. When W.G. Stone was finally sent to segregation in cell block 3, it almost seemed like a godsend. There, he had regular access to meals, toilets, etc., but it was definitely not perfect, and boredom ran amok. The prisoners had no access to television, radio, reading materials, or anything like that. Their only possible activity was writing letters to outside correspondents. If they had any, that is. More than half of the prisoners in the New Mexico State Pen had no correspondence with anyone, so they were mostly left to their own devices inside segregation. After 2 weeks in segregation, W.G. Stone was sent to general population. There, he began to learn how Gen Pop operated, and was soon sucked into a world of violence. Inside general population, Fish, as they were known, were locked up alongside lifers. Fish were prisoners that were incarcerated for a short period of time, usually on non-violent crimes, such as drug possession, theft, etc., while lifers were the long-tenured prisoners, who were usually locked up for violent crimes or repeat offenses. Tensions were often high between the Fish and the lifers, and W.G. Stone, who was stuck in the middle, his fate lasting anywhere between a decade and a lifetime, learned that in order for him to survive his sentence, he needed to stand up for himself. Because the lifers were locked up for a large portion of their lives, sometimes the rest of their life, they had very little to lose. The Fish, on the other hand, were still hopeful for parole, but would have to begin battling if they did not want to suffer for the duration of their stay. In the early days of his prison life, W.G. Stone got into a fight in the penitentiary kitchen, a fight that resulted in another man dying. However, because of the prison staff not caring enough about evidence collection, he faced no charges or consequences. However, he received a reputation that allowed him to spend the duration of his sentence mostly unimpeded. Regretfully, that reputation resulted in him being denied parole at the first opportunity. And following that decision, when his fate was looking less and less certain with each passing day, he was sent to cell block 5, which hosted the worst of the worst. Inside the New Mexico State Pen, cell block 5 housed the toughest and most violent inmates. These were mostly white and Hispanic inmates who were locked up on violent offenses, such as assault, sexual assault, and murder. According to W.G. Stone, the cell block was rife with weapons, which survived multiple shakedowns. These included weapons such as pipes, razors, and knives. The prisoners inside cell block 5 would often bully and harass other cell blocks and dormitories, even going as far as regularly stealing and extorting other prisoners if they felt like it. In essence, they pilfered other convicts, and faced close to no consequences. If anyone felt like resisting, they would face a merciless assault from the facility's worst inmates. Inside cell block 5, they also regularly made what was called homebrew. That's what the convicts called it, at least. You or I may consider it prison swill. This consisted of some combination of potatoes, tomato puree, raisins, water, yeast, and sugar, which would ferment for days or weeks inside plastic containers. These containers would be hidden inside the cell block, and the homebrew would be consumed regularly by those in the lawless cell block 5. Throughout the 1970s, as more and more members of biker gangs began to get arrested for drug dealing and drug running, prison chapters of the Aryan Brotherhood began to grow in prominence. This was very noticeable inside cell block 5, and during W.G. Stone's tenure inside the cell block, he soon found himself sharing a cell with a predominant Aryan Brotherhood population. The original state penitentiary had been constructed in 1885, standing as New Mexico State's first public building, predating even the first universities and hospitals. After all, New Mexico wouldn't even reach statehood until 1912, but this facility, constructed just outside of Santa Fe, would feature a long history of violence and bloodshed. The institution was constantly overcrowded, especially in the time period following World War II. Violent riots erupted over food and deplorable conditions in 1948, 1950, and 1952. In an incident preceded by an escape attempt and followed by a general strike and a forced resignation of the warden. Another violent uprising would occur in 1953, in which 31 guards and staff members were taken hostage by convicts. This riot was only quelled when the deputy warden, one of the aforementioned hostages, managed to obtain a smuggled-in pistol and shot two of the riot leaders. This riot sparked massive overhauls and triggered the construction of a new facility, which would end up becoming the state's new penitentiary. The new state pen would be commissioned on April 20, 1956, and New Mexico Governor John Sims, having expensed its budget at around $8 million, proclaimed it was, quote, among the most advanced correctional institutions in the world. The layout of this new facility featured a center square-shaped building which served as the main portion of the prison. The administrative wing was featured up front, and then there was a large courtyard in the middle of the squared structure. On the other sides of the building were the gymnasium, the kitchen, and the dining area, among a number of offices and hallways. On one side, in a series of buildings resembling two connected letter H's, were some of the dormitories and cell houses. This included dormitories A, B, C, D, E, and F. Dormitory C was later turned into the education unit. This side of the prison also featured cell houses 1 and 2. On the other side, in a similarly shaped structure, were four cell blocks, cell blocks 3, 4, 5, and 6. This also included the hospital and psychology units of the prison. At the time of its construction, the New Mexico State Penitentiary was among the best in the nation. However, as the facility began to receive inmates well beyond its capacity, and state funding began to decrease, this facility aged very quickly and very poorly. Within two decades, the institution was worn down, out of date, and in desperate need of new leadership. The first warden of the New Mexico State Penitentiary, J.E. Baker, was a well-respected veteran of the state's Department of Corrections. His tenure as warden was marked with a near excess of federal funding, which was put towards incentivizing good behavior. This included things like educational programs, work study, and much more. Warden Baker had a reputation for being fair and was relatively well-liked by his staff and inmates. Among his ranks was a young man named Felix Rodriguez, who would quickly become one of the most infamous figures in New Mexico prison history. Rodriguez had served in the United States Army during the Korean War, then returned stateside and applied for a job as a prison guard. There, he became known as part of a clique called the Santa Fe 11, a group of prison guards and officials that would later rise in the ranks and end up joining and leading various components of the state's corrections department. Rodriguez worked for the original New Mexico State Pen as a guard and was then promoted in quick succession from guard to lieutenant, from lieutenant to captain, then captain to associate warden, and then from associate warden to deputy warden in 1957. A little over a decade later, in 1970, Felix Rodriguez succeeded J.E. Baker as the state penitentiary's warden, having earned himself a reputation as an official that was fair to inmates, but also known to hold grudges. One of his major overhauls came with the implementation of a snitch network, which gave rewards, such as access to the aforementioned educational programs, to those that snitched on other inmates. However, those that refused to cooperate, such as those that wanted to serve out their sentence, avoid prison drama, and go home, were then punished. They were often labeled quote-unquote snitches and held in solitary confinement for a time, the hole, as it was known, before then being transferred to cell block 5. There, they would have to endure vicious beatings and sexual assaults at the hands of the violent lifers. A criminal investigation was launched into the tenure of Warden Felix Rodriguez in 1975. Ultimately highlighting the rampant drug use found inside the prison, as well as the countless safety issues presented with his network of snitches. Following this investigation, Rodriguez was removed as warden, but what followed was a string of sycophants that followed his direction, and aspiring visionaries that lacked the necessary conviction to enact wholesale change. Ralph Aaron was a lifelong federal warden, who was not used to the distinct personalities of the New Mexico prison system. In particular, Felix Rodriguez, the charismatic ex-warden that had been removed from his position, and then failed upwards into the Department of Corrections, supervising the prison system from his office at the state capitol. Ralph Aaron had none of Rodriguez's charm, and tried to clamp down on the security issues inside the state pen. In particular, he did away with any incentive programs, such as the educational and work programs, which offered inmates a hope of a better future and a temporary escape from their day-to-day survival. This turned out to be a colossal failure, and Aaron resigned from his position after only 6 months, but not before being able to hand-pick his successor. In came Clyde Malley, an acquaintance of Aaron's that continued his established hard-nosed response. The educational and work programs were permanently discontinued, and all inmates were removed from administrative positions. This meant that all of the prisoners were now just that, prisoners. They had nothing to preoccupy their time, and, as you can imagine, this led to a lot of dissent. Malley's tenure as warden saw more than a dozen escapes, due to existing security procedures, and Malley himself became critical of the prison staff he had inherited. He openly critiqued the lax security measures, at one point calling an escape attempt, quote, a complete breakdown of security, established procedures, misinformation, lack of responsible leadership, and general chaos. In 30 years of corrections, I have never witnessed such a total breakdown of prison practices. In June of 1976, Warden Clyde Malley oversaw a sit-in in which prisoners refused to go to work, where they earned pennies on the dollar, as well as refusing to go to their meals. Some of the organizers had typed out a list of grievances with the prison system, which included an oppressive administration, an infestation of rats and cockroaches throughout the facility, rotten food, and broken toilets. In response to this sit-in, a total lockdown of the prison was ordered, and, inside their dormitories, inmates proceeded to completely tear apart the dorms themselves. Over 500 inmates participated in this act of rebellion, and, ultimately, 4 out of the 5 dormitories were completely trashed, requiring extensive repairs. These prisoners were then forced out of their cells and dorms with pepper spray and tear gas. Then, the 500 to 600 participating inmates were forced to strip naked before being marched 20 to 30 at a time through a corridor for interrogation. This was done in an effort to find the organizers of the strike, presumably for punishment. And when the participants refused to talk, they were then marched naked down to the gymnasium, where they had to walk through a gauntlet of guards and staff members that beat them with axe handles. It was noted that even the prison chaplain participated in this, eventually earning the nickname Axe Handle from prisoners. Clyde Malley refused to hear out the list of grievances listed by the inmates, instead choosing to clamp down on the organizers of the sit-in. When he found out who had organized the protest, he stuck them in segregation cells for months at a time, an act that is now deemed cruel and unusual by the federal justice system. Ultimately, Malley would resign in 1978, less than 3 years after his appointment. He was succeeded by a man named Jerry Griffin, who had previously been the warden of a minimum security prison in Roswell, New Mexico. Griffin worked alongside his newly appointed deputy warden, Robert Montoya, who was actually one of the original Santa Fe 11, alongside former warden Felix Rodriguez. Montoya and Rodriguez were actually close friends, and it soon became public knowledge that Montoya was running the day-to-day operations of the prison, while Jerry Griffin served as a more ceremonial warden to appease the state's congressional leaders. Under this administration, the snitching network of Felix Rodriguez was reinstituted. Warden Griffin and Deputy Warden Montoya began cracking down on prisoners that did not play ball, labeling unpliable convicts as snitches, even if they had not informed on anyone. These men would then be put into cell block 4, where the snitches, child molesters, and the weak were kept in isolation for their protection. Here, they wore distinct uniforms that made them stand out among the rest of the prison population. In essence, if an inmate went to cell block 4, they quickly became a dead man walking. If they were ever returned to general population, let alone to the fearsome cell block 5, they were targeted for a short, miserable life of violence and sexual assault, thus making them more likely to talk in the future and cooperate. Warden Jerry Griffin became known for refusing to take suggestions from the prison psychologist, whose concerns I'll get to in a bit, and for locking up mentally ill inmates in the hole, where they were left to anguish. Sometimes he even just kept them in general population, where they often met a swift and brutal end. However, I should state that it remains unknown just how many of Warden Griffin's decisions as an administrator were his own, or, rather, were implemented by his deputy warden, Robert Montoya. Montoya was close with Felix Rodriguez, the former warden that had become a high-ranking member of the various committees that controlled the New Mexico Department of Corrections, and many think that he was still in control of the overarching decisions made throughout the facility, despite being removed as warden nearly 5 years prior. In a prophetic letter dated July 6, 1979, a prison guard at the New Mexico State Penitentiary, named Bob Runyon, wrote to Felix Rodriguez. Runyon, a former Air Force intelligence operative with a degree in criminology, was appealing to Rodriguez, the former warden turned deputy secretary of corrections. In this letter, Runyon claimed that he had recommended changes to the penitentiary's senior officials, but his concerns had fallen on deaf ears. As such, he was appealing to a higher power, concerned that danger in the state pen was imminent. It is also worth noting that a short time after this letter was written, Bob Runyon resigned from his post, not wanting to become a casualty of a system he viewed as broken. In this letter to Felix Rodriguez, Runyon proposed a new intelligence system which could replace the snitch network that had ineffectively been running the prison for close to a decade. In his proposal, he warned, quote, lacking this system, I anticipate serious incidents in the near future of corruption, the introduction of contraband, escapes, riots, hostage taking, and ruthless killing of inmates. Later that year, 1979, a report was published calling the New Mexico State Penitentiary, quote, one of the most poorly administered prisons in all of America. This report, which became highly touted in the months after the eventual riot, cited the cells as being both unsanitary and cruelly constructed. Each of the cells were a pretty uniform size, roughly 6 feet by 9 feet, but were both unventilated and not insulated, meaning they became frigid cold in the winter months and then stifling hot throughout the summer. In addition, a much too late series of repairs being done to cell block 5 had resulted in those inmates, who were among the most violent in the entire prison, being housed in other dormitories and cell blocks. This resulted in not only an extreme case of overcrowding, with multiple inmates having to sleep on the floor, sans any blankets or pillows, but a rampant spread of violence, sexual assault, and overall tension. To make matters worse, the prison itself was becoming run down and downright disgusting. Many of the inmates' toilets had been broken for weeks, if not months, and would simply not flush. In addition to making each cell a nightmarish mix of overcrowded inmates stuck with the aroma of feces, rats and cockroaches had infested the cells. In perhaps the most aggravating incident for inmates, Thanksgiving of 1979, inmates were served turkey described as, quote, smelling, green, and rotten. Even the inmates that ate around the turkey described food poisoning in the days afterwards, which added to their complaints. Perhaps the most pressing concern on the mind of most inmates, though, were the prison guards themselves. If you were to ask an inmate incarcerated at the turn of 1980, most would tell you that the guards were allowing violence to happen, as long as it did not involve them personally. They were alleged to let the escalating violence go unchecked, as it allowed them to keep some semblance of order within the penitentiary. And for the record, I'm not including this because I think all prison guards are dirty or anything like that. Corruption is definitely a topic I'll broach throughout this series, but most of the guards employed at the New Mexico State Pen were inexperienced, having worked at the facility statistically for less than 2 years. A large percentage of these guards were high school dropouts, who earned significantly less than counterparts from neighboring states. So, of course, they did not have much incentive to put their life on the line for the job or an inmate. Those that did want to change the system for the better, like prison guard Bob Runyon, who wrote a letter in July of 1979, asking to overhaul the intelligence system and warning of imminent danger, were often ostracized or let go from the staff. However, despite me stating that not all of the guards were corrupt or cruel, there were definitely incidents that pointed to some of the guards being one or the other, if not a large contingent of the guards. Throughout the 1970s, multiple events had been staged involving the beating of inmates via axe handles, the likes of which you've already heard, where prisoners had to run a naked gauntlet through the hallways as guards and staff members hit them with axe handles. In other cases, there were more overt signs of cruelty, such as a case involving a prison guard sticking his finger into an inmate's eye socket, stuff like that. In other cases, guards were known to utilize psychological torture upon the inmates, such as reading and then discarding their mail right in front of them, which was often the inmates' one escape from the horrors of prison life. In other cases, guards were known to flirt and taunt the visiting wives and girlfriends of inmates, sometimes openly, in front of the inmates themselves. And it's not like the inmates could call them on it, risking putting a target on their backs via a trip to cell block 4 and being labeled a snitch. In some other cases, inmates were called. Guards would taunt prisoners with details about calling, dating, and even sleeping with their loved ones outside of prison. This included wives and girlfriends, whose contact info they were able to easily obtain from their prisoner files. It was stuff like this that was continually breaking the spirits of almost all the prisoners. One inmate later recalled, quote, "A convict's code of honor is to tend to business and not to lie, steal, cheat, or screw another's woman. The officials at that pen did it all." Dr. Mark Orner was the head of the psychology wing at the New Mexico State Penitentiary, who was tasked with providing counseling and therapy for the inmates in the facility. Starting in November of 1979, the same month that inmates were fed rotten turkey, Dr. Orner began to receive multiple tips warning him of a pending riot. He was one of the few people that tried to encourage the inmates to move on to bigger and better things, and one of the few people inside with the resources and willpower to actually help inmates in need. This endeared him to many of the prisoners, who often fed him information regarding the inner workings of the facility. Later, when speaking to state police, he would state, quote, "I get good information whenever there is going to be heavy shit." On November 30th, he actually reported these warnings to prison officials. He stated that he, as well as other staff members, were being floated as possible targets for the uprising, and would likely be taken captive as hostages. After all, the psych ward, in addition to the education wing and the infirmary, were attached to the dormitories and cell blocks of the prison. They were all three easy targets, if an uprising were to occur. After warning senior officials about this possible threat, Dr. Orner would later tell state investigators that he was brazenly mocked. During a January interview, he would even state about this reaction and his concerns. Quote, "I'm not going to be in this fucking place with 20 officers on a weekend. And when I warned them, they laughed. They thought it was funny." In the final half of 1979, a major section of the prison was undergoing renovation. Cell Block 5, the most dangerous cell block in the state pen, was closed due to long-awaited upgrades and repairs. Many of those inmates were transferred to other dormitories and cell blocks for temporary housing. However, managing to take advantage of the weak security placed on the construction zones near Cell Block 5, some prisoners had managed to sneak in during the day and they smuggled out an entire hacksaw, which they then took back to their dormitory and hid. On December 8th, 1979, a Saturday, 11 inmates took advantage of a sleeping guard to make good on an escape plan. It ended up becoming the second major escape in 2 years, and was especially dangerous because 5 out of the 11 escapees were convicted killers. Thankfully, all of the escaped inmates would be recovered in the ensuing days and weeks, but the only people to face any punishment for the escape were 2 tower guards that were fired. Of course, they were partially at fault, but that ignored a wide range of security issues that led to the prisoners obtaining a fucking hacksaw, hiding said hacksaw in their dormitory for several days, and then being afforded enough time to escape. This escape hinted at just some of the major concerns investigators and legislators had with the New Mexico State Penitentiary, which was beginning to reach a point. In the coming weeks, a report was published which critiqued the prison's security regulations and standards, or rather, the lack of them, but ultimately changed nothing. A quote from this report read as follows: "We cannot afford to wait for another major incident and hope again that our resources and planning will come together before the situation becomes critical." Following the December escape attempt, paranoia was at an all-time high from the prison staff. The escape had put an embarrassing blemish on the track record of both Warden Jerry Griffin and his deputy warden, Robert Montoya. A search of the dormitories and cell blocks produced no further tools or weapons, and, as days turned into weeks, the state pen began to slip back into normality. And by normality, I mean the same uncomfortable, tense environment that had been festering for years, aided by overcrowding, unsanitary and unsafe conditions left untreated, and a building monitored by a staff that was paid too little to actually care. As the shock of the escape began to wear off, a number of preventative measures were not taken, if not forgotten entirely. By later estimates, the riot control grills separating each dormitory from the main corridor were left unlocked for anywhere between 5 and 7 months, a time period that preceded the escape attempt and then the eventual riot. This points to a lackadaisical effort by guards, who simply could not be bothered to lock the doors behind them when they did their regular security checks. In addition, 2 of the penitentiary's riot control gates were left unlocked, which was made all the more dangerous when the central control booth, the part of the prison that acts essentially as the brain of the prison complex, was given blind spots. I mean that literally. New shatterproof glass left blind spots for prisoners to exploit. And, perhaps most horrifying of all, it was found that this shatterproof glass was actually not shatterproof. I'm not joking either. When the glass arrived, staff tested the glass and found that it was easily broken by brute force, a fact that they would simply try to hide while they waited for the originally ordered shatterproof glass to arrive at the facility. These conditions would point to a state building in disarray, but this was surprisingly business as usual in the New Mexico State Penitentiary. Least of the prison's concerns was a work order submitted for the nightlights in dormitory E2. Which would illuminate the dorm during the evening hours, when guards had to make their rounds and collect a headcount. This just so happened to be a section of the prison where many of the dangerous, violent prisoners from cell block 5 had been temporarily moved, while construction in that section took place. The absence of these lights would make evening headcounts a nightmarish endeavor for prison guards, but the work order would go unfulfilled for months, as prison officials tried to focus on more pressing concerns. Needless to say, this would go on to play a part in the later prison riot. W.G. Stone, the prisoner whose story I detailed earlier in this podcast, remained at the New Mexico State Prison from 1962 to 1979. In 1979, after spending the better part of 2 decades behind bars, Stone was finally released on parole. Following his release, he was able to obtain employment at a halfway house, where he worked as a maintenance man. For a time, he continued on the straight and narrow, but a few months after he was released, he was arrested on charges of rape. It is worth noting that these charges were later rescinded, but this allegation resulted in Stone later being charged with association with a felon, due to his work at the halfway home, where he often encountered felons because of his job. Ultimately, his parole was revoked, and he was sent back to the New Mexico State Penitentiary, awaiting an appeal. This was in December of 1979, the same month that the ill-fated escape went through. When he came back to the state pen, he was sent to dormitory C1, which had been nicknamed the Old Man's Dormitory, because it consisted of veteran prisoners that could not cope with the chaos of general population. In this dormitory, he was the 48th out of 40 planned prisoners, meaning that he again became a victim of the penitentiary's widespread overcrowding. Following his reincarceration, W.G. Stone began to hear rumors of a long-planned riot, something he had heard rumors of before his parole earlier that year. This time, though, the whispers had grown in volume and intensity due to the Aryan Brotherhood now conspiring with the Hispanic cliques, an alliance that would span a majority of the prison population. As the rumors began to increase in intensity, Stone knew that he would have to make a decision between joining in with the riot, or earn the ire of other violent inmates if he decided to abstain. It was a dilemma that many in the facility found themselves in. Having to choose between the devil on either your left or your right shoulder, you could either partake in harming others, or find harm cast upon you. These rumors continued through January, when the psychology and security departments warned senior officials of, quote, imminent danger. They knew things were growing out of hand when several inmates in Dormitory E2 began requesting transfers to other dorms or cell blocks, an action that is usually a precursor to mass violence. On Friday, February 1st, 1980, a full moon cast its glow over the New Mexico State Penitentiary. Throughout the daytime hours, the mood in the prison was described as both palpable and raw by inmates and staff, who could feel the tension in the air as thick as fog. Guards would later recall large groups of inmates speaking in hushed tones, as if they were conspiring. A female secretary for the prison even called in sick, later stating that she feared some kind of disturbance that morning. Nothing happened in the daytime hours, and business proceeded as usual. Paperwork was shuffled around, with some of the prison staff pushing off the last of their Friday work to the following Monday. This included the new intake paperwork, which included prisoner details that had just arrived to the institution. These documents were kept in the office of the associate warden, and the staff members that handled this paperwork would later disagree on the total number of prisoners in the prison. After all, when the staff left the prison that Friday afternoon, they had no idea that they would not be able to return as they did the following week. To them, everything was just as it normally was. Things did not start getting rowdy until that evening, when a dozen or so inmates sat around a table in the day room of Dormitory E2. These inmates, a mix of white and Hispanic inmates, were largely transplants from Cell Block 5, the worst that New Mexico State had to offer. And as they sat around this table, conversing and joking and conspiring, as paranoid guards would later recall, they were drinking some homebrew. This homebrew, which had been made by an inmate nicknamed Blabbers, had been created by him putting water, fruit, yeast, and sugar in a hefty bag, and letting it sit in a shower pipe chase for a little under a week. That Friday night, they decided to crack it open, and were partaking in a longtime prison tradition of getting drunk on swill. Danny Messias, one of the inmates in E2, described what this homebrew was like. Quote, "We had a lot of sugar and a lot of yeast, and that creates a lot of alcohol. And when I went up there to get it, I brought it down and I opened it. Oh, it's powerful stuff. How they didn't smell that stuff is beyond me. It smelled like a brewery in there." This particular inmate was speaking, of course, about the guards, who had gone through their dormitory at around 8:30 that evening, doing a head count before lights out. Ever since that head count, the inmates had been sitting around the table, drinking and getting drunk like they weren't even incarcerated. However, their conversation always brought a reminder back to their current status as prisoners. After all, they were hatching a plan to kick off a long-awaited riot, and were hoping to take control of the prison by surprise. As their confidence swelled and their inhibitions lowered, these inmates decided on a plan of action. They would wait for the guards to perform their night check just after 1 a.m., at which point, the inmates would attack them from the shadows. From there, they just had to hope that the rest of the inmates in their dorm would back them up and participate, thus encouraging a snowball effect that would ultimately result in the prisoners' grievances being heard by the press. These inmates decided, just before midnight that those who did not participate in the riot would face the brunt of their aggression. In the early morning hours of Saturday, February 2nd, 1980, shift captain Greg Roybal joined corrections officers Michael Schmidt and Ronnie Martinez as they closed the day room of dormitory E2 and took headcount for the night. Earlier that evening, these men had heard talk of drinking in that day room, so they were somewhat cautious and anxious. This had been what inspired Captain Roybal, a 20-plus year veteran of the state pen, to join them. Because of that same concern, they were then joined by Lieutenant Jose Anaya, who himself had more than 20 years on the job, doubling the usual guard used to close down a day room. Captain Roybal was especially wary of dormitory E2 because of not only the increasingly urgent rumors of a pending riot, but because the unit was now filled with inmates from Cell Block 5. This made E2 perhaps the deadliest part of the prison, especially when you considered some of the violent prisoners might be drunk. Because of this risk, and a doubling of the guard, an unfortunate oversight was made. The four guards combined had with them keys to the entire south wing of the facility. This was especially dangerous because if these keys were to end up in the hands of the inmates, they would then control half of the prison, and it would only require an overthrow of four men, two of which were in their early 50s. As these four guards began to enter dormitory E2, one of the men, Ronnie Martinez, a younger guard, remained outside. He was, in essence, the lookout and the last line of defense, who was supposed to guard the door as the other guards made their rounds through the dorm. However, as the other three men walk through the gate into dormitory E2, Martinez makes the crucial mistake of not fully closing the door, which would automatically lock it. Schmidt, Roybal, and Anaya enter the dormitory and immediately grow concerned when they remember that the nightlights in E2 have yet to be replaced. This left large portions of the day room and the housing unit in pitch black, and as the three men enter the dorm, they are soon enveloped by darkness. It is in this short period of time, mere seconds, at around 1:30 a.m., that the riot begins. Utilizing makeshift shivs, anywhere between a dozen and two dozen inmates attack the three men, stabbing, punching, kicking, and trying to overpower in any way possible. Some of the inmates are emboldened by the homebrew they had been consuming for hours, feeling drunk or dizzy enough to feel no fear. Captain Roybal and Lieutenant Anaya, both middle-aged men of small stature, are easily overpowered, as is Michael Schmidt, a younger corrections officer of good stature who is just overcome by multiple men that take him down. The overlook by Ronnie Martinez to close the door ends up immediately blowing up in his face, as he is stormed simultaneously by multiple inmates, who open the door and physically drag him into the day room. Within a matter of moments, the inmates of dormitory E2 have taken four prison guards hostage, and the riot has officially begun. Following their capture, the four prison guards taken captive are stripped naked, bound with torn bedsheets, and then blindfolded. What would follow would be a seemingly endless period of time in which the four are beaten, stabbed, spit on, tormented, sexually assaulted, and even urinated upon. One of the prisoners decides to put on Captain Roybal's uniform and begins leading approximately 10 of his fellow inmates through the prison hallways. These men were tasked with trying to find another batch of guards that were working on the south side of the penitentiary, whose capture would result in the prisoners having total control of that half. Because of the ignored security procedures, this batch of inmates were easily able to make it through unlocked doors and security grills. They had taken the security guard's keys following their capture, but for the most part, they did not even need them. The guards had left the path behind them mostly unlocked. In just a minute or two, this roaming band of inmates, led by a prisoner wearing Captain Roybal's uniform, encounter the other collection of security guards. Correction officers Juan Bustos and Victor Gallegos are both easily subdued by the dozen or so attackers, while Elton Curry, nicknamed Bigfoot, puts up a bit of a fight. In the end, he is stabbed in the side and then subdued, becoming another hostage for the prisoners to barter with. Unbeknownst to the inmates, another security guard has been with these three men. Herman Gallegos, of no relation to Victor, heard the commotion building up in a nearby hallway, and was able to duck into the day room of another prison dormitory. There, sympathetic inmates would take him in and hide him during the subsequent riot, shielding him from any harm. The three security guards are brought back to the E2 day room, joining the other four already taken hostage. There, the beatings continue, as the prisoners begin to take out their aggression from years of perceived mistreatment. Three guards, in particular, would receive a brunt of the sadistic sexual assaults from the inmates. These are guards that had earned reputations for being cruel to prisoners, and the prisoners tried to remind them of their past mistreatment. As this horror show unfolded in the day room, a riot leader led a procession of convicts to begin unlocking other dormitories on the prison's south side. Within 15 minutes, more than 500 inmates had been let loose. Inmates that began arming themselves with anything they could find and grab a hold of. Within half an hour, just 30 minutes after the ambush of the guards in the E2 day room, the riot would be spread throughout the entire facility. Prisoners had control of every cell block and dormitory with the exception of just two. Dormitory D, which the guards taken hostage had no keys for, and Dormitory E1, a protection unit for convicts that had already been violently beaten and sexually assaulted by other inmates. This also included snitches. Upon hearing that a riot had started, the inmates inside Dormitory E1 began barricading themselves inside their cells and housing units, for fear of the sadistic torture and loss of life that waited on the other side. This brings to a close part 1 of the New Mexico State Penitentiary riot. Part 2 will be made available in just a few days, and then part 3 a few days after that. If you would like to follow along with the podcast, you could find Unresolved on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. There's also a Facebook discussion group for those interested in some behind-the-scenes discussions. If you want to get in touch with me or the podcast, you could send your emails to michael@unresolved.me. That's M-I-C-H-E-A-L at unresolved.me. And you could send voicemails or text to 831-200-3550. That's 831-200-3550. All of this information, as well as links to the podcast store, the Patreon page, etc., can be found at unresolved.me. Once again, that's unresolved.me. Until next time, everyone, stay safe, and I'll talk to you all again very, very soon.